Good evening, this is Peter Hill Explains, where we enter into a fairly interesting conversation, I hope, about things to do with physics and teaching. What I've done recently is get up to scratch and read through and read aloud the physics syllabus and the various contents for it, and actually planning how you would provide coverage of every point with podcasts, websites, full series of internationally interlocked resources for us, for our or my Aussie students, so to speak. Now, as with all this, various people I think may have heard me over the various months slowly recover and get on top of things. Now I've gone through and just subconsciously I've already got little chunks of the syllabus breaking off into little bits into my brain, or whatever it is, not my brain, just thinking about it. There's a sort of standalone chunk in it won't make a lot of sense to you, but there's four modules in the last year of school physics, and the last module in year 12 is our last year, is Universe to Atoms, it's called. This is not prepared, this is going straight out of the top of my brain, and you have various modules. I just have to really recall it in my head. Various modules going through. I was talking about the structure of the atoms. I have to really get into my head at which stage they put the Big Bang, in which place they put the atoms. But the structure of atoms, the actual classical physics, is broken up. At one stage, the students have to know a cluster of experimental results, which is six experiments, which I've remembered that off the top of my head, and the experiments are the properties of electrons, the Thomson experiment, the Geiger-Mazdan experiment, the discovery of neutrons, the Rutherford experiment, electrons, properties of electrons. So there's six of them. Oh yes, the Millikan's drop. So let's go. There's groups of three. Sorry, this is the top of my head. I don't have it here. I'm just walking in this Australian park over here. It's sort of village green. There's a cricket pitch and a beautiful ancient gums, they're 100, 200 years old, and construction sites going on and things like that. Getting back to it, so the module has an electron section, the properties of electrons, the Thomson experiment, the Millikan thing, that's the electron bit, and then for atoms you have the Geiger-Mazdan experiment. When I first went through, I said that was in my head. It got a bit foggy. Then the Rutherford experiment, and then the Chadwick experiment. Now, I haven't had much of a chance. I think only about an hour, maybe about 5 hours ago, I just read it through for the first time. So I haven't had a real chance to go back and look at any notes. However, I've done a few of these experiments, looked in detail at some of these experiments. So I'd like to talk through it with you while I walk around here. So at least I don't get bored doing this walking, and perhaps there's some for you. So that's the overall summary. So the property of electrons experiments are a series of experiments. I suppose the two ones which can be shown in the or three ones which can be shown in the classroom is the Crookes Maltese cross experiment, and this involves, so let me just talk through it, this involves a evacuated tube. Now I'm not going to explain the Oh dear, this is difficult. I'm not going to explain this. The way it's taught is misunderstood. So what I'm going to do is explain. So if you've had experimental stuff, you see, you automatically, because if you've built things, vacuum things, you see immediately, you know, what the pressure is, what's going on. So I'm going to tell you what's going on, and it's not necessarily what you see in textbook. In fact, I've never seen, I must admit, I've built these things, I've not seen one correct textbook. So this is the advantage of this podcast, you'll listen to it. So the Crookes thing is a tear-shaped evacuated glass tube. It looks like straight out of the 1880s, and it is around that time. And it has two nipples on it. So how you do is you blow your glass, and I've actually blown glass, so I know a little bit about it. And you attach two tubes to your glass. So you blow your glass up, blow two tubes to your glass, attach two tubes, and in those two tubes, you eventually attach electrodes, but you also can, while the tubes are under vacuum, if you heat them up, the tubes will collapse and form a vacuum seal. So you've got two things, one for the cathode, the source of the cathode, and the other one is for the anode. So the cathode will be positively charged, and electrons which are negatively charged will... The electrons will build up on the cathode, so it's a cathode ray tube. This is getting me a bit confused. So the cathode's the negatively charged one. We have to say that. It's a cathode ray tube. So the rays which come from the cathode. So you build up a huge negative charge. So I'm going to draw it in my head from the left to the right. From the left is the cathode. And up there is an aluminium or brass button. These beautifully curved things. They don't have edges on it, so no voltage builds up on it. And the reason it's done there is that this is an extension of discharge tubes, and from the discharge tubes to work, you need a... because it's done as a series of shock waves at low pressure. This is... it is actually shock waves. You get, so if you get striations, going back to it, something else, if you get striations, that's equivalent to plasma shock waves. So your striations and different flows, and look, that's what a striation is, a shock wave. Okay, now and a standing shock wave, that's what it is, it's a standing shock wave. But to get that shock wave thing, you have to start off with this button anode, and this is sort of like a red herring for you, because electrons do not emerge uniformly as a wave, a plane wave, from that button cathode on the right. Cathode ray. I'll have to go through it in my head. So this is why I'm talking here. I'm going, oh, the electrons come from the cathode because they are cathode rays. So the cathode must be negative. There is this thing to do with chemistry of cathode and anode being slightly different. So electrons, you put this up to a high voltage source. Now, as far as this is concerned, you just say it's a high voltage source. No longer in the course do you have to explain about a interrupted inductor where the actual current is stopped and you're looking at the... the Faraday effect. This is I have to really go back into my head. See, it's all scrambled, everybody, right? But the sudden collapse in the current means a sudden collapse in the magnetic field, which means there's a differential. The EMF is proportional to the negative change in flux. So you have a interrupted transformer with a pulse going through it all the time, and that creates high voltage. So that goes to your negative electrode. And what happens is, and what in actual fact happens, in a Maltese cross apparatus, is that a thin plasma positive column extends from the positive electrodes up and sits as a cone, just sitting microns, in fact, or millimeters ahead of the aluminium electrode. So you have this virtual ghostly electrode come up as a tongue and actually sit just above the anode, and this creates a very high electric field over the anode, and you get cold emission. So normally, to get emission of electrons from a metal plate, you have to have it heated up. Now, what the combination of things happen here, you get a huge electric field which allows electrons to leave the metal plate, get over the work function, and temperature ion bombardment of that small electric plate will allow electrons to emerge as a point source, like a pinhole. So the electrons, you basically have a pinhole electron light source from your cathode. So if you've got one of these, go into the school lab and have a look at that cathode, and you'll see a little burn mark. So everything I say is true. So you have a pinhole light source, a pinhole electron source. Now again, this is not necessary for people to say in exams. And this will issue electrons as from the point source and give a magnified shadow of your metal cross. And the metal cross coming out. And so that will show that electrons travel in a straight line, as it looks like, a bit like light coming out, because it's coming from a point source. But then you have electron, electrons be deflected by a magnetic field by the we call it the right-hand slap rule. Down here in Australia, we've got the right-hand grip, right-hand slap, and the rule for pointing the various things. There's the right-hand grip rule. Yeah, I just have to remember all there's the three rules for it, so I'll just get that back into my head. So that shows electrons go in a straight line. Now, L, got the name of the scientist. Oh God, this is what I'm doing, is my friends. So there's a scientist, a German scientist, who fired these rays against a very thin metal foil and got electrons to actually leave the vacuum tube and travel a small distance in space. And this was evidence that perhaps the electrons either travelled through the metal, or it was like light travelling through a very thin foil. It was a wave. And it's L. The name's gone from my head. Sorry, mate. Then you have another demonstration with the phosphorus and the electron beam. So the electron beam eventually gets more and more developed. So you have a hot source, point source of electrons. So electrons emerge from a point source. They've got a local acceleration that may be heated up to get a substantial current. And then there's a series of holes which actually has a series of lenses. So that's getting towards the Thomson apparatus. You also have another demonstration of electrons physically hitting a surface and imparting momentum to it, the electric paddle wheel surface. Then you also have a similar, the Crookes radiometer, It's just with light particles hitting, but then when they hit the black surface of your paddles, heat up, and that means that the particles bouncing off that surface get more of a kick from that surface, and then that actually imparts greater recoil momentum, which gets it moving around. So your crux radiometer will, your back surface will get a greater push from it. So they're the three sets of basic models I've just got to remember. So look, this looks great news for me. I'll go back and get all those memories back and locked in. And so they're the actual basics of it. One of the things that they did is, we'll say, or an electron, does it respond to an electric field? So you have this tube, an electron gun, a set of electric plates either side. And this is one of the things the Sylvius has thankfully put to death now. You no longer have to do a cathode ray tube or a crow or anything like that, because these are old technologies and they've just let them go. But you've got a series of plates, the electron. Now, I've done a fairly good few YouTubes about 7 years ago, so this is why I can see some memories not as good, because I could do these YouTubes off the top of my head, and now, so many years later, it's hard to get back. So you have these plates, an evacuated tube, the vacuum is improving all the time, but you have these plates, and the plates initially indicate you put a positive and negative charge, but you don't get the positive and negative charge showing up between the plates. You put the 10 volts and you don't get 10 volts electric field between the plates, and so the electrons don't move. And so the reason that is, so the electrons are going through, you expect it, if it's a charged particle, it will be deflected by electric field. But initially that isn't the case, can't be done, because the plates have a polarizing effect, that molecules in the tube stick to the surface and polarize, creating a massive electric field between the molecule and the plate, and then a weak electric field from the molecule out into space, and then off to space to the next molecule on the other plate, which has a huge electric field. So your electric field doesn't uniformly go across space. It's actually shielded by a polarizing, a polar molecules on the surface of it. And indeed, look, we can use the opposite effect of that to make supercapacitors. So you win some, you lose some. Now, Thompson, T-O-M-P, Thompson. Now, the interesting thing, I think his son got involved in the Nobel Prize, which disproved his work. So he got a Nobel Prize for proving what he thought was an electron is a particle, and his son was involved in getting the Nobel Prize for proving that electron was potentially a wave or a wave particle. And then, of course, people like myself, many years later with supercomputers, it's just a wave. That's all it is. Okay, so let's get back. He's got this tube, and so what he initially sees is he's got a phosphorescent screen, so it shows the electrons. When it hits a glow screen, the kinetic energy gets converted to light, and it's a slightly conducting screen, so the electrons don't build up. And you have to have that in your old cathode ray tubes. You have to have a conductor on the front of your screen, will actually just build up charge. He sees a momentary deflection. So when he first turns on the electric field, he sees a very quick deflection. So the very early experiments, he could just see it flicked for a fraction of a second and is eventually drove out. Now, he balanced the electric and magnetic field. So the electric field would pull the electrons upwards, so he could put a positive charge on the top of the thing, so he could get the charge of it. And then he could balance that by determining the velocity of the field by measuring the radius of curvature from a magnetic field in a Helmholtz coil, which provides a uniform magnetic field, not by a magnet, but by placing it in a effectively large solenoid. And new to the course is that you have the formula for B from a solenoid, which is NIL. Yeah, NIL. I think there's something else that I have to go in for a solenoid. So he'd get first off the radius of curvature and then the equivalent electric field. And I can't do it in my head anymore. I used to be able to do it in my head. That would give him the mass charge ratio. Now, even at this stage, they had the mass of an atom due to electrical baths. They had a mass of an atom, so he could work out that the mass charge ratio that the electron. The atom was something that the electron was just a tiny, tiny fraction of the mass of an atom, and this is where the our course is stuck in the 1910, where we've moved on. So he came up with the plum pudding model, Thomson's plum pudding model. For the atoms, it must be big. The electrons are a tiny fraction of the mass. They're like the equivalent, like your the atom he viewed as a plum pudding. We in Aussie Australia, I think we might have a plum pudding if you know some poms come along, they might have a plum pudding for Christmas, something like that. But in general, probably closer is you've got your mashed potatoes and a few peas, and you stick a few peas in your big clump of mashed potato model. So he recognized that the positive thing weighed a hell of a lot and the peas weighed a little, so your general common sense would tell you that if it weighs more, it's got to be bigger. So you can imagine your shock if you give someone a block of chocolate and you give someone else a Smartie and they just it just drops to the floor. You know, what's going on here? There's something incredibly different. But that's actually what happens in atoms. In quantum mechanics, as I said before, there's no surfaces. The electrons are bigger. Schrodinger wave equation says that if it's got less mass, it's wave. And Drolli's equation also says that if it's got less mass, it's got a bigger spatial extent. But that was... Thomson's model of the electron, and then much later after that, so that's him, and he did various things. So there's two steps to it. One is work out the magnetic field, work out the radius, work out the velocity. From the velocity, I think velocity is B on E. MQ, B on E. And from that, he can work out the mass charge ratio, which led him to produce the the plum pudding model, or as we Aussies would like to put it, the mash and a few peas. Something I don't think anyone has ever had a plum pudding. I've never had a plum pudding. I've never seen a plum pudding. The only time I've ever heard of a plum pudding is this person from ancient times telling me that an atom is like a plum pudding, which is quite an interesting thing to say. The next experiment is the Milken's oil drop experiment, and this one I've got a lot of experience for, because in my undergraduate days we had third year, I think, Milken's oil drop thing, and basically you have a little squirter which produces very fine oil droplets. You measure the radius of the oil droplet, you know, the density of the oil droplet, and blood oath, I can remember it now. You actually watch the oil droplet fall. You make the oil droplet. You can't measure the radius of the oil droplet with a microscope, but you can accurately measure the you can measure the speed that the oil droplet falls through the air. Okay, so you got your microscope, you do the squirts, and you measure the speed that the oil droplet's falling through the air, and the rate of falling through the air, speed of falling through the air, gives you, through a series of calculations, you know the density and you know the air Reynolds number for a droplet falling through air. There you go. So a very fine droplet will drop at a certain rate, but then you have an alpha particle source. Do we have an alpha particle source? I think we had a small accelerator. We have an ion source. I can't remember the apparatus quite well now. I could almost walk up to it now. No, the building, the whole place, I can visualize it now. So I can even feel it in my hands, so to speak. Kind of looking through, I can see the screen, I can see pretty much everything. It's pretty amazing to get the memory back. So you got your alpha particle source, and the alpha particle source will either ionize one or two or three electrons, and what happens is that so you get a discrete amount of ionization, and then you have an electric field which then suspends the field in between the field, and what you do is that hold by varying the dial and the voltage, you hold the droplet in your microscope at the same height overall, and look, you can let it drop a bit more and pull it up again. You can, you know, it's almost too hard to get it to sit there for a while, so you get a bit of an overkill, a bit of an underkill, and you take the average of it, and so on average it stayed still even though you're moving it up and down, and you get a series of numbers, and that gives you an integer number of charges, and in general I don't think I ever got a single charge on a drop. We've always got four or seven or something like that, add it together and infer what the charge charge on an electron was in terms of coulombs, because your F equals EQ, you've got the E from the voltage and the distance. And so you could work out what the Q is and what the minimum Q is. So the Milken oil droplet experiment used F equals mg, but that was, so we've got the G, and the M was from the Reynolds number of watching it drop, knowing the density of the oil, and you charged up and found the charge on the electron. I hope that actually put you there. For me, this went right back to where I can even see the colour of the illumination at the back. So it was quite a nice afternoon. I just can't remember. I just want to remember who I did the prac with. So that's how many years ago? 1986. A fair number of years ago, mate. I'm 85. So that's a fair number of years ago I did that prac. And you poor bastards at the moment, you have to recollect that prac. I don't think it's really relevant at the moment. So that does the electrons to it. Then we've got to move over into the atom bit, sort of the two sides of it. Now, the people, I think, the middle bit is Rutherford doing his calculations. Now, in general, what happens is that, there's been a whole series of experiments. The Geiger Mauer has done experiments, and they generally have it asked about in the textbooks that they did the Geiger-Marsden experiment in 1913, and then Rutherford there, who's in the Manchester laboratory. And it's really interesting actually plot this out, how they came up with the radium, because they got that directly from the Curies, I think directly from a garden party. Rutherford went to a garden party and they showed off the radium. They said, oh, the whole feast of scientists said, oh, this is bloody interesting. And took their particles away. I'm sure it was done more officially. So they got the green glowing radium. And so the official story is they only did one experiment in 1913, which is a fair whacker time ago, and Rutherford saw this experiment and he said, look, the atom is mostly empty space, it's a small positively charged particle. But indeed it was a series of 1908, 1909, 10, 11. So the 1911 experiment, Rutherford did a prediction from it of a positive charge, and the 1913 experiment was the final proof of Rutherford's prediction. But the way textbooks tell you, it's the opposite. They did the experiment and then Rutherford interpreted it. Well, that actually wasn't the case. So, similar to the Maltese. Oh, look, there you go. The Maltese cross. Again, the Maltese cross. I haven't heard this officially. The Maltese cross experiment going back. The story I heard was that they couldn't actually produce it in Britain at the time, the Maltese cross early on. They got Germans to produce it, and the Germans put a German symbol, German cross, in the top there, and that indeed the original crosses were German crosses, but for political reasons they called it a Maltese cross instead. There you go. So, similarly here, I'll tell you the real story of what's going on, but I'll try and tell you the direct story. Now, again, I'm not trying to impress anyone. I've just read the syllabus a few hours ago and just clocked it across, and you can possibly check. I hope I've got all the facts right. So, I've read a bit about Rutherford. He was a Kiwi, I think, yeah, and snapped up by Manchester University, which had more money, heaps of money, to set up a lab, and said, go for it. And so Geiger and Marsden were good experimentalists. Rutherford, I don't know necessarily, was such a fantastic experimentalist. But they went through a series of experiments, and we'll talk about the 1913 experiment, and that was, so look, on the internet and everything, they show it's appalling. Can I say it's appalling? They show this basically room size apparatus and alpha particles from a source going across and hitting a foil, and people around the outside hitting it and looking at little scintillations, so it looks very large. But indeed, I'm trying to think of the apparatus is probably the size of one of your small mini saucepans, saucepan you'd use to boil one egg. So look, I'm just trying to tell you what the apparatus looked like, and I don't know, I just looked at it and said, early on, and said, oh, how did it get the angle, how did they see it, how did they rotate it? So, essentially, let's build it from the inside. Firstly, they've got a stick, and stick vertical. Imagine you've got a vertical stick. In the vertical stick, you've got a holder for your foil. And for your foil, you got your holder for your foil, and then just a really small distance away, come a hole, was your holder for your, well, technically radium. Okay, they didn't have a whole heap of ideas about what the radium was. So what happened is that Marie Curie discovered radium, but then she listed all these different types of radium. So when she discovered radium, she discovered gaseous radium, which is what was it? Radon gas. And then she discovered radium A, B, and C, and D. And so different radiums were different. So radium is under the periodic table under group 2, and these are way up in group 13, 14, stuff like that. So you've got the bismuth, there was just one up from lead. So you've got different radiums. So they initially used all radiums together, and then they began to be a bit more savvy and they used the radium gas, which is the radon and stuff like that. And what they did was a serious experiment. I'm going to tell you the 1913 experiment because that's closest to what they expect you to do at school. You've got your stick, you've got your foil, you've got your radium source, a little pinhole source, only a short distance away, in the size of a thing which is the size of a the stick. You put that stick down a vacuum pump hole on a table. So the table has a hole in it and it's a vacuum pump. And then what you do is that you put scintillator would be zinc sulfide, that's what they always used. We used to have a salt. I think we used, I was going to say aspirin, but it was sodium salicylate, which we use as a scintillator all the time. But they had used zinc sulfide. So I assume, I don't know how they got it on. So they had this thing, a hole in the table with the pump came through it, and the pole came up through the centre. So you put on top of this entire apparatus an upside-down saucepan with a microscope in it. And you can use, by rotating that vacuum system around, you can check the different angles, really broad angles, from this. And this is one of the things that I only really, my physics professor at the time, Jeff Opak, derived it. And then he derived spherical scattering, which is, well, it could be, it's not spherical scattering, is it? So this is the scattering from the nucleus. It's scattering from the nucleus, and so they were able to observe large angle kickbacks. So a majority went straight through with a small variation, and then occasionally they would hit the nucleus end on, and have a recoil backwards. And the fact that it was a big heavy thing, it showed that all positive charge was in a small heavy thing, and that the nucleus appeared to be, the atom appeared to be mostly empty space, which quantum physicists would beg to disagree with. The atom is just full of electron goop, so to speak. What happened is you have a little dark chamber microscope, you look at it for a long time, and you can actually count the number of scintillations. This is the alpha particle will hit off and deposits its energy there. You have to have the entire thing evacuated, mate. Definitely this is a fundamental thing. So the fundamental thing is that your beam of alpha particles gets fuzzy if it goes through air, as it bounces and stuff like that. And so the alpha particle hits the zinc sulfide crystal, excites a photon through the band gap, and emits radiation through the electrons dropping down again. So you can see the different angles. And I've done an artwork on this. I might post this artwork up, produce it. So occasionally I'll put an artwork up there with it. Okay, so that's a classic experiment, and the idea that we're told in the textbook is that Rutherford walked in the room and said, "Eureka, I know what that means. It means that the nucleus, I've discovered the nucleus," and he coined the word nucleus, which is a more positive charge. Now, the system goes a little bit more different. So that's the official story. I'm giving you the realistic story, so I've given you the actual apparatus they use, and hopefully you'll be able to check up from. I can't remember where I remembered all this from. So it went through. First thing is they got their alpha particle source. They got a range of alpha particle energies, created a beam, and they put a scintillator in air, and the beam was a fuzzy beam. So they put it in a vacuum chamber, 1908, I think. Put it in a vacuum chamber, and when they pumped out the gas, the beam wasn't any fuzzy anymore. But when they put in a metal plate in front of it, the metal plate caused it to be fuzzy. So they found a small angle scattering from it. Then 1909, probably the next year, I can't remember all these experiments. In 1909, they made a handheld iridium source, and they had a scintillator plate, zinc sulfide scintillator plate, and a piece of lead to stop it, and they got it to bounce off different nuclei, and essentially the heavy gold, platinum, lead, the alpha particles would bounce off. This is 1908, but it wouldn't bounce off aluminium. So that was another experiment, open experiment. Then they did a few more vacuum experiments leading off. And then they sort of worked on, so 1911, there's probably another experiment there, I can't quite remember. 1911, at one stage, look, they got a good alpha particle source, so they could use radon gas, whatever they want, and they could control the velocity of the alpha particles by the amount of mica. So mica, if you have your good old 1950s Cold War Garg counter, that still has a mica foil on it. So mica is this sheet cleavage mineral, which you can use as a very thin window, vacuum window. And amazingly, I've seen pieces of apparatus 40 years old still hold a good vacuum with it, so it's a pretty amazing material. But they put different levels amount of it to actually slow the alpha particles down, then go through a vacuum system, and then scatter off different metals. And then with a microscope, they could actually count and see the fuzziness pattern. And it's, I think, 1911 one, the fuzziness, they get the first sort of little bit of the curve, and Rutherford therefore knew from the 1909 or 1910 one, that things bounce through a large angle, then you've got a very good first part of the curve, and I think it might have been 1911 he produced the paper, whatever it is, a few years before they he then had news that knew that it was a small population of things at a large angle, and he had exquisite accuracy at short angle, and so he modelled it as scattering of most empty spaces. Like, he predicted the nucleus in empty space way a couple of years before, and had a formula, and the formula had a some sort of trigonometric function, which I'll have to get back and known. So I suppose the interesting thing is that I was at uni and they derived a scattering matrix, an S matrix to it, which gave a perfectly circular scattering function, which sort of made sense. I remember Professor Opat just doing a basic scattering hard sphere. Oh, yeah, it wasn't hard sphere scattering. I don't think it was hard sphere scattering. I think the Rutherford model had a scattering of a Coulombic potential, which is different. A Coulombic potential scattering is different from a hard sphere scattering. And so this is what got me really confused, because back at university they did the hard sphere scattering model, which is fairly straightforward. That hard sphere scattering, and you do it in your school lab all the time. We have marbles hitting each other, which is an example of hard sphere scattering, where the actual distribution is different, but Coulombic scattering is different. It must be different, and so that's why it's different. So he did a Coulombic scattering. In fact, he did. And so he had the two charges there of the alpha particle and the nucleus, and had a formula, and they just chogged through it and proved that the scattering profile existed, his Coulombic scattering profile, which is different from what they, the simple things that they say in HSC. So, look, the major difference is that the way that's told, the way it actually happened is quite interesting. It's quite methodical, and it's a bit by bit guided. So the final experiment was so unequivocal, because it was going to prove unequivocally the Rutherford's equation and exquisite detail of Coulombic potentials. That is interesting. I just worked it out here. Okay, yeah, and it's even got the approach being the kinetic energy in. So that actually makes sense. So if you've got a very low kinetic energy alpha particle going in, the nucleus appears very large. And that makes complete sense. Yeah, so if you've got very low energy alpha particles, it does get scattered more. I'm just seeing the formula in my head. Okay, so that's Rutherford. And so they then say, what's Rutherford's prediction of it? Which is rather strange, because the actual experiment was confirming Rutherford's prediction from 2 years prior. Just a small thing. You'll get marked down, you poor kittens that are trying to do it. The next one is Chadwick. Now, there's a little thing of how we're going for time here. Wait. Okay. I should go back in the next 10 minutes. Okay, so Chadwick, interesting person. Chadwick, again, I think in Manchester University or some British university, a very intensely quiet man, wanted to do accounting, went to university, got lost and got convinced to do physics instead, but was too shy to actually say he didn't want to do it. So he had a lot of personality, well, I wouldn't call it problems from my perspective, you know, liberation, mate, it's really not worth all this worry. Yeah, and so look, there's a backstory to it in terms of that Marie Curie's daughter had said, "Hey, Mum, what's this going on? I have these phantom particles going through, and we can't detect them, and they're knocking off hydrogen atoms. So basically it's a snooker thing. Imagine if I had an invisible snooker ball and I could hit it across. You wouldn't see it, but you'd suddenly see a ball move out. So that was discovered by Marie Curie's daughter, who got a Nobel Prize anyway. Her mum, which was Marie Curie, convinced her that it wasn't so. But there's a whole lot of funny things going on there if you read it. I might, one of these days, you can't actually get I haven't seen a good biography of Marie Curie, or as I've heard people in Australia say, have you heard of this person called Marie Curie? Marie Curie. But, I think someone thought she was a man at one stage. Who is Marie Curie? Getting back to it. Chadwick basically deduced the neutron by the trail and momentum of the particles ejected out in Wilson's cloud chamber. So this is not until Wilson's cloud chamber is not until 1930s. Look, 32 is the dead in my head. I've got also 36 in my head, but 36 is the liquid drop model. So it's probably 32. Just off the top of my head, he looked at the particles knocked out by the neutrons. So the neutrons he'd have a source and he'd put a lead block in the way. So the lead block meant that it couldn't be gamma rays, it couldn't be protons, it couldn't be alpha particles. They couldn't get through. These neutrons were getting through. I don't know whether he had a splatteron source. Splatteron source is where an alpha particle hits beryllium and produces it has to be 32 or even earlier than that, because then Enrico Fermi did his neutron experiments in 36, so you can't have anything more. He looked at the thickness of the cloud trails. So if you have a microscope and you look at the Wilson's cloud chamber trails, I don't think they had photographs back then, you could see the velocity and the charge of various things. And I can remember it knocking a proton out of nitrogen or various things, so you could actually see identified the particles being knocked out by his cloud chamber, being a conservation of momentum process. So we get the opposite with cyclotron radiation, where we fire a proton into a nucleus and dislodge a neutron. So that's how Chadwick discovered the neutron, and with the discovery of the neutron, we then have the Z number, and it's beginning to rain at the moment, so I better get back off it there. So that's in summary. I don't know whether this has been any help to anyone listening in, but that's just a rundown of the those three dots, three points in the syllabus, in the quantum quark syllabus, and you can see the overall problem that, say, if you have people organising this who are, in inverted commas, you can imagine me with my two fingers, but I can't actually do this, quote, experts, and they haven't actually done the experiments themselves, or they haven't researched it, or they haven't just, yeah, look, they're not experimental physicists, so they don't go, there's nothing in them which goes, hang on, how does that happen? hang on, why does a charge, say in the Maltese cross, why does applying a positive charge generate over here off to the right, 10 centimetres off to the right, generate a acceleration of electrons perpendicular to the plate? How does that work? Or hang on, wait for a moment, what's that dark mark in the middle of the Crookes plate that's going on? Or this old Thompson experiment's got gas in it, doesn't work. Oh, you can get to work a little bit if momentarily. So and you, you know, I'd go through it. Or you haven't, they haven't actually done the Millikan drop experiment, and so you see something in a textbook, it's wrong, and what happens is that you say, oh look, I did the experiment, and they say, well look at the authors here, look at them, they're all, and you go through, and they're all teachers who've never done the experiment. I don't have a shred of bad will in my body. But you gotta say, as they say, you gotta say, mate. Okay, it's now absolutely bitterly cold, it's pitting rain. I've got to get back to my home up in Glenbrook, which is about 2 blocks away. I'll be a wet, sorry person, and I don't know if the football team my family were watching have lost. I'm just going to be in a rather sad time, especially because I'm South Australian. They were playing a South Australian team, so there's a sort of a huge resentment here. So it's a national football code. I know you are all probably looking at the World Cup, but at least Australia knows it doesn't have a hope in the World Cup, whereas I'm just really feeling an extreme feeling of unreality if I was a Russian at this point in time, so asking what was going on. So all the best, and I hope you enjoy watching the World Cup. Bye.